Good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, Finn at OffbeatOregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Since it's Wednesday, we're going to be reading something from 2010 today. Thank you for loading me down and queuing me up, and I hope you enjoy the show. This is the story of the bloodiest Oregon jailbreak of all time, the one in which Harry Tracy, the last Wild West outlaw, was gunned down. The gunfighter from Butch Cassidy's Wild Bunch, that would be the hole-in-the-wall gang, was trying to shoot his way back to Idaho and rejoin the gang after breaking out of the Oregon State Pen in Salem. He ended up killing a total of 11 men. This story was first published on July 11th of 2010. Here we go. The golden age of outlaws lasted from just after the Civil War until the turn of the century when they ran out of places to hide from the law. But did you know that the last of those outlaws, an associate of Butch Cassidy, lived, and worked, if you know what I mean, in Oregon? Dapper, charming, and deadly, 27-year-old Harry Tracy was Oregon's strongest connection to the world of professional Western outlaws such as Jesse James and the Dalton brothers. By the standards of his peers, he wasn't a particularly successful robber, but he was remarkably adept at breaking out of jail, and it's for this. In particular, a bloody breakout from the Oregon State Pen in 1902, followed by an even bloodier two-month manhunt, this is what he's remembered for today. Tracy was on the run after breaking out of prisons in Utah and Colorado when he came to Portland back in 1898. He soon met up with a local rowdy by the name of David Merrill. He and Merrill became friends, and Tracy became more than friends with Merrill's sister Rose. The two of them were married shortly after they met. Everything was great until the money ran out, and Tracy and Merrill had to go out and get more. This they did with a particular style and panache that quickly got them into the headlines as the McIntosh Bandits and the False Face Bandits. But although Tracy was a stranger to them, police already knew Merrill pretty well. He was on their list of usual suspects, so of course they sent a detective out to check him out. Police found him hiding upstairs, no doubt surrounded with stolen goods, and under questioning, he told them about Tracy. When Tracy came back to the house, he figured out something was up and ran for it. After trading pistol shots with a detective, he jumped a train to flee, but by an odd stroke of luck, the conductor disabled the train right next to a butcher shop that Tracy had robbed earlier. And the butcher's son was ready with a shotgun full of birdshot, which he let Tracy have at relatively close range. The badly wounded robber ran a short distance, but finally gave up, and was sent off to serve a 20-year sentence in the Oregon State Penitentiary in Salem. Once in the pen, Tracy got busy doing what he did best, planning an escape. Having somehow arranged for some money to be sneaked in for him, he bribed someone. No one knows who. To hide a pair of Winchester carbines in a pattern box in the prison foundry. He bribed a soon-to-be-released inmate named Harry Wright to get a rope ladder and toss it over the prison wall. On the morning of June 9th, 1902, everything was ready to go. Tracy and Merrill went to the foundry, opened the box, gunned down two guards immediately, and started the breakout. By the time they got out of the prison yard, they'd killed four guards and wounded a fellow inmate. A fifth guard, shot and dying, was used as a human shield until they got outside, at which point Tracy put a final bullet through his head and the two men ran for it. Thus was begun a two-month manhunt covering most of northwest Oregon and much of western Washington as Tracy and Merrill tried to get back to Hole-in-the-Wall, Idaho, headquarters of the Wild Bunch gang, not knowing that Cassidy and company had fled to Argentina the previous year. They were headed for Washington, stopping when they had to get a meal or even a bed at farmhouses along the way. After all, who was going to deny hospitality to two armed and desperate men? Bloodhounds were called in from Walla Walla. Tracy sneaked around and mixed his scent with that of the pursuing posses, confusing the dogs. Then the governor announced an $8,000 reward for the two men's capture, alive or dead. This inspired dozens of ad hoc citizen posses to pour out of saloons from Salem to Seattle, most of them thoroughly braced with spirits. The result was a chaotic landscape of heavily armed drunks looking hopefully over every backyard fence for Tracy and Merrill. Quote, "The whole damn country was full of militia and many of the boys were potted," Detective Joe Day of the Portland Police Department told writer Stuart Holbrook many years later. "They shot at everything, and Clark and Cowlitz County sounded like the Spanish-American War all over again. It was the most dangerous place I was ever in." These boozy posses may have made the countryside dangerous for everyone, but they were no match for a professional killer like Tracy. On the few occasions when they found their quarry, they quickly found themselves wishing they had not. After crossing the Columbia, Tracy shot his brother-in-law dead. That is, according to the officially accepted story he did. Some sources say he read in a newspaper that Merrill had cut a deal to deliver Tracy in exchange for a reduced sentence, and after challenging Merrill to a duel, Tracy shot him in the back. However, in his book, 13 Years in the Oregon Penitentiary, legendary Portland waterfront Shanghaier Joseph Bunko Kelly writes that the body brought back to the state prison and identified as Merrill's was not his, that Merrill's ankle was scarred from the Oregon boot shackle that he once wore, and that the corpse's ankle was undamaged. Writing in 1907, 5 years after the escape, Kelly also tantalizingly writes that, quote, "Merrill is still alive, or he was last year." Of course, Kelly always was a smooth and easy liar, so his word isn't to be taken as gospel, but it is not outside the realm of possibility that Tracy might have done his wife's brother a final favor by letting him go home and framing up some poor bystander to stand in for his corpse. Either way, he was now on his own, and he continued making for Hole in the Wall. He made it as far as Creston, beyond the Snoqualmie Pass, before he was pinned down by police in a wheat field. After taking a bullet that cut a leg artery and another one that broke his other leg, the dying bandit put himself out of his misery with his Colt 45. Tracy had been on the lam for 58 days. He'd killed 11 people along the way. During that time, he'd furnished eager newspaper readers with a gripping story, and by the end, he was the most famous person in the country. When he was finally dead, souvenir hunters stripped his corpse bare of clothes and hair, and authorities felt it was necessary to melt his face off with vitriol, that is, sulfuric acid, so that his corpse could not be dug up and put on display by some enterprising body snatcher later. By the way, the melting of the face might lead some to wonder if the body brought back really was that of Harry Tracy. Yeah, we had to melt his face off so that people wouldn't be able to recognize. Yeah, that's it. But if we can believe Bunko Kelly, that body, when it was brought back to the state penitentiary and displayed to all the inmates, was most definitely that of Harry Tracy. It's David Merrill that Kelly thinks got away. Tracy was the last of a dying breed, the breed of the hard-living, deadly American outlaw. A few years later, the rest of the hole-in-the-wall gang, having been tracked down and identified by Pinkerton detectives, would be wiped out by a detachment of Bolivian soldiers. America was changing, and with it Oregon, and there was no room for men like Harry Tracy in the new America. Not even in the rough, wild frontier state of Oregon. There's an afterword on this story. After this article was published in the Creswell Chronicle, a gentleman from Wisconsin named Jim Gardner got in touch with me. Jim, as it turns out, is related to Harry Tracy, whose real name was Severn, Tracy Severn. Tracy's family was not proud of him, and when he died, the Severns did not exactly rush to publicize the connection. In an age that had great faith in the power of genetics, having a vicious killer in the family made the neighbors wonder about the rest of one's clan. Enough time has gone by, though, for Jim to be comfortable telling the full story, which he did in the Journal of the Outlaw Lawman History Association in 3 articles in the early 1990s. Tracy grew up in Pittsville, Wisconsin, a child of a highly respected and successful family, and as a youngster gave no sign of any predilection to a life of crime and murder. One critical item to keep in mind if you are going to do any further research on the Harry Tracy story is the remarkably low quality of some of the historical sources on this event. There is something about an outlaw story that seems to bring out the liar in writers. Of particular note, Jim tells us, is an article by Ray Hastings in True West magazine, published in 1972, which claims, among other things, that the young Tracy raped and killed his Sunday school teacher. As I learned when doing the research for this story, it's hardly the only historical account of Tracy's life whose author enhanced it a bit. You will need to crank up the sensitivity level of your BS detector to the max for this one. Well, that is our show for today. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. In addition to this podcast, it includes a weekly newspaper column, a daily RSS feed to catch on your smartphone newsreader, a series of live history shows, a Facebook page, and a couple of other minor components as well. YouTube channel, Tumblr blog, things like that. All of it is accessible through our anchor page at offbeatoregon.com. Visual goodies and other resources that go with today's show can be found at offbeatoregon.com, where you'll also find full citations to the sources for this story, as well as more than 250 other Offbeat Oregon history columns written over the past 5 years since I've been doing these. Like this podcast, those articles are covered under a Creative Commons license. For details of that, see offbeatoregon.com/cc. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band, atlasstringband.com, and it was written by Carmen Ficarra. I do Offbeat Oregon history for fun and to learn things. I don't ever want it to turn into something I dread, something like a J-O-B. So I don't sell advertising or ask for donations. But if you enjoy the podcast and you'd like to support it, you can always buy a copy of my book. If you enjoy this podcast, I can almost guarantee that you will like the book. It's called Wicked Portland. It's published by the History Press in 2012, and they're available at community bookstores. Or if you like, you can order a signed copy through the store link at offbeatoregon.com. It sells for $20. Finally, if you're ever in the neighborhood near Oregon State University, drop me a line. Maybe we can grab a cup of coffee in the library coffee shop and talk history. I'm Finn at offbeatoregon.com. Our next show will be coming your way around 6 a.m. tomorrow morning. That's Thursday morning. Until then, go out and fill up the rest of today with good stuff. Bye now.